I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Welcome to everybody there. I'm Alex Clark. This is Chris Power. Welcome to everyone wherever you are. We already know that people are joining from all around the globe, Chris. Chris has been slightly ruining that by when we've been being told where everyone is. And he says, oh, I've got some friends there. You're not supposed to say that. It's probably just your adoring public. So, you know, it's not just your mates.
That's right.
I'm very, very excited that we're going to be talking about A Lonely Man tonight, which is just one of my favourite books this year so far. I know it's only the 1st of April, but still, I don't mean to dally you with vague praise. You are, of course, the author of the short stories Mothers, and this is your first novel. Now, I would normally do an introduction there, but you kind of wrote it for me, because the book starts with two men meeting at a bookshop reading. A bookshop that's possibly similar to the London Review of Books bookshop, I think. It's got that sort of vibe. Our hero has gone to see, who is a writer, has gone to see a writer he sort of liked, may like, giving a reading. And he is introduced thus. The moderator says, thank you for everyone for coming to hear from one of the breakout voices of the year, one of the most exciting young writers at work in Britain and indeed all of Europe today. Says. So you're setting it out there quite hard, and indeed all of Europe. So I felt I ought to use that as an introduction to you.
Great. I'm not going to complain.
Well, I must say, then there is a short reading, and I enjoyed it. Then the introducer reads out a string of adjectives from book reviews, but your book was published today, so we haven't seen those book reviews. But there have been lots of advance words of praise for the books. But I love the moment that the young man writer then reads from his book, and Robert, our hero, says, Dallow was talking about columns of light falling onto a forest's floor. And I thought, that seemed to me like just the kind of writing you don't want to do. That didn't seem to me, that seems sort of slightly edgy to me, slightly unpraiseful. Is that fair?
Well, I think it's fair that it's, I mean, from Robert's perspective, Robert's there in a sort of, he's quite embittered. He's sort of jealous, really, of this younger, much more praised writer as all writers do. Writers are people who look at, you know, other people who do what they do and envy and hate them for it, rather than sort of finding a sense of community. And I guess he's seeing that the road that he wants to be on, that this other guy is on. Although, you know, Robert's had a book published, and there'll be other writers who are looking at Robert and feeling exactly the same thing that he's feeling towards Dallow. So there's a sort of serpent eating its tail element to it, I suppose.
Yes, there they are at one of these interminable readings, the library. We've been to many of them, at which Robert describes himself as not really able to concentrate. You're always looking around for the drinks trolley, etc., etc. And he has also met this slightly weird and bumptious man who is very clearly drunk and rather brilliantly, in my view, has taken miniatures of vodka along to the reading. And this is our introduction to the setup of the novel. A writer, a British writer, living in Berlin with his wife and two children, stuck on his book, meets this chaotic, slightly charismatic, also slightly seedy character. That's about right, isn't it?
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. It's yeah. I mean, their sort of relationship is, it's not really where the idea for the book started, but it did become the dominant force in it quite quickly. I think, I guess it's kind of also always the case that what you start writing is very rarely what you finish writing. In my experience anyway, it always sort of transforms along the way, and you're kind of like clinging on to an idea for dear life for a while, where it sort of rides where it wants to, and you sort of find yourself in this new space, and then that's when the real writing begins in a way, where you're like, okay, now I know what this is, and I can sort of shape it. There's a sort of chaotic period before that, I think.
So with this book, which I think you're going to give us a reading from after that, then we'll chat about book, about mothers, about all sorts of other things, wherever the conversation takes us. We love you in the audience, in the virtual audience. We wish we could see you, but we can't. But you can send us a question in the Q&A box, and we'll come to some of those questions towards the end of the hour. But this is essentially the idea. Was a writer always at the heart of the book when it was taking shape? Did you always know it would be about a writer? In fact, sort of two writers in a way.
No, it wasn't. It actually started with a sort of grim fascination I had with Alexander Litvinenko and things related to that, like this, you know, this assassination that happened in London in 2006 and was a huge news story because it had this strange, you know, performative aspect to it. You know, it was all sort of in public. You know, Litvinenko mm-hmm. was poisoned with polonium, this radiation, and weirdly was in a position where he could kind of work to solve his own murder while he was still alive to an extent. He knew he was dying. All the doctors knew he was dying, you know, once they realized what this agent was. But he still had, you know, a couple of weeks of life left and was interviewed by, you know, Scotland Yard policemen and stuff. And that was very strange and fascinating. And many people were, you know, sort of captivated by it. And I sort of stayed in touch with that case just as something I was interested in. And there were sort of repeated, you know, the British government didn't really want to point any fingers. And so it was a case that stayed in the news because Marina Litvinenko, his widow, was sort of campaigning for an inquest into the investigation and into the killing. But it's just something I'd check in with occasionally, you know, when an update occurred. But then a few years after that, I was working around Piccadilly, and I would sometimes go and get my lunch at this branch of Itsu, you know, this fast food sushi place. And somehow, I can't remember how, like reading a news report or something about Litvinenko, I discovered that this had been the branch that was his favorite restaurant in London. And he went there often, and he actually went there on both occasions that Lugovoy and Kovtun, these people, tried to poison him. The first time they had a meeting with him and he had this cup of radioactive tea in front of him for half an hour and he never drank it. And then he took them there afterwards. And then a few weeks later, they came back and were successful in, you know, getting him to drink the tea. But before that meeting at a Hyde Park hotel, he went to this Itsu again and met this Italian ex-secret service guy who actually said, you know, you're on a Kremlin kill list because of stuff he'd said about Anna Politkovskaya, this reporter who'd been gunned down outside her apartment in Moscow. And there was something about being in that space and realizing this was that, you know, Itsu that after Litvinenko died and they started like searching for polonium and realizing what they were looking for, they found, you know, worrying levels of radiation there, and it was shut for months and fully like stripped out and refurbed and stuff. And it was just odd, you know, this story that was so fantastical in a way. When we follow these stories, they're like sort of thrilling in a way that is maybe not particularly wholesome because there was a, you know, a death of a man with a wife and child at the heart of it. But there's something sort of, like I said, grimly fascinating about them, and they seem so unreal. But being in that space, it was a strange crossing of sort of mundanity with this very unusual, fantastical, thrilling story. And it sort of collapsed the gap between those two things in a way I found really fascinating. And again, it just sort of sat there in the back of my mind, I guess, until a few years after that, I read a long form piece of journalism about 14 deaths that had happened on British soil of Russian nationals and British nationals, oligarchs and money men and lawyers and fixers. And all these cases had been under investigated, or evidence had gone missing, or crime scenes hadn't been photographed. And the reporter, Heidi Blake, she had a whole team of reporters, but she was the lead reporter. You know, her thesis was that all to do with sort of high levels of corruption and unwillingness to sort of put Russia in the dock for sort of political and economic reasons. And something about this piece sort of connected with my previous interests in that regard. And that was when I really started to wanting to write about it. And I didn't really know the way in. At first, I thought of someone who was involved in that world. I didn't really want someone who was sort of implicated. Like, I wanted an innocent, in a sense. And that's actually where the idea for the writer, you know, a ghostwriter, someone who can legitimately be in that world and explore it without being of it. That was where it really started germinating, I think.
Well, the book kind of becomes about a ghostwriter of a ghostwriter in a certain way. Will you just give us a little reading that kind of introduces these two sort of central characters to us?
Yeah, sure. I'll just read the first couple of pages of the book. They met in St. George's in Kollwitz-Keetz, both reaching for the same book. "Sorry," they said together, drawing back their arms. "Please," Robert said. "After you," said the other man. His speech was slurred. He stank of alcohol. "Don't worry," Robert said, turning away. "I've got it. I just wanted to look at the cover." It was an edition he hadn't seen before. He would wait until the man had gone. He heard a cough behind him, then a gruff, "Here." He turned and saw the man smiling a little stupidly, angling the cover towards him. He looked at it and nodded. "Thanks," he said. The man flipped the book over and studied the back. Robert watched him sway. "Any good?" the man said. "Most people like the later stuff better, but I think it's great. I like everything he did, though, so maybe you shouldn't trust me." The man made no response, just stared at the back of the book. He yawned widely and scratched his cheek. Robert wondered if he could even read the words he was looking at. "He died about 10 years ago." The man grunted and opened the book. Robert went back to scanning the shelves. He wasn't really looking for anything, just killing time before the reading started. St. George's was a 20-minute walk from his apartment, and over the last couple of years, since moving to Berlin, he had become a regular there. Sometimes he brought his daughters and set them up with colouring books on one of the cracked leather couches in the back room while he browsed the second-hand books in the front. Tonight they were at home with a babysitter, and Karin was going to meet him for dinner after the reading. She had suggested recently that they make an effort to spend more time with each other, away from the children. "Would everyone take their seats, please?" a bookseller said. Robert moved towards the back room along with a few other browsers. Feeling a hand on his shoulder, he turned and saw the drunk, still clutching the same book. "What's the event?" the man said. They were about the same age, Robert thought, with a shared accent, London or nearby. "Sam Dallow." The man looked back at him, expressionlessly. "He's a writer? He's talking about his new novel." "I'm a writer," the man said. "Great," said Robert.
The last thing you want, isn't it? Somebody, you're there at a reading and tell somebody you're a writer and they say, "Oh, me too." So it's presumably every writer's what he's come to listen to a writer, and now there's another writer trying to muscle in on the act. But he is a writer. You don't mind. You're all right.
Nicer than Robert.
Now, Robert, as you say, we'll investigate Robert a bit more, but he's not always that nice, although we do root for him quite a lot. But the point about Patrick, who he meets, is that he is a drunk and he is kind of a bit unreliable and a bit wild and very socially odd. But he has this backstory, as you were explaining. He has been hired to write a kind of book on behalf, a sort of, I don't know, a kind of exculpatory book in a way, a kind of, you know, Jacques Hughes sort of book for a Russian oligarch, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. I mean, the nature of that book is actually always in question. I don't think Sergei Vanyashin, this oligarch who hires him, wants to write some sort of Jacques book about against Putin. This guy was a sort of second tier oligarch. There's also questions about exactly how wealthy he is, but he had a radio station in Russia and he had a small but respected newspaper that were critical of Putin, and then he had to leave Russia. And he wants, when he hires Patrick, he describes this book he wants to write. But over subsequent meetings, as Robert learns via Patrick, it does seem to change and shift. And Vanyashin seems like someone who sort of acts on whims. He keeps lots of people on retainer, so like just paying them money, like in case he wants to make use of them. So yeah, the exact nature of the book and what it will finally consist of, and what it, you know, it never quite comes to pass, but is always in some doubt.
Well, I guess the kind of exact nature of the book that you've written is also in doubt, and that's one of the kind of games that you play with us, because there is this sort of thrillerish element to it, because the guy who's going to be writing the book about the oligarch, Patrick, fears for his life. He thinks he's beat, but we don't really know whether that's true or whether he's just a bit crazy and weird and unreliable. And then it becomes something very different about Robert and what he might make of this meeting. And it strikes me you could sort of think of this book as a kind of thriller, as certainly as a mystery or as a suspense novel. But how useful was it to you to think in terms of kind of crossing all those genre?
It wasn't useful, really. I mean, I didn't really think about it in those terms. I definitely thought about it in terms of wanting to maintain and sustain tension throughout. But I think that's something I'm kind of always interested in. I think that was something I was interested in the stories in Mothers, which are very not, you know, thriller-ish. But obviously I was conscious of the fact that, you know, if you're going to talk about oligarchs and assassination and the FSB and the GRU and, you know, as soon as you're bringing like acronyms in, you're definitely in different territory. And I think that it was useful to the extent that in the form of the book, or how I wanted the book to move, the rhythms of the book, it was sort of useful to think in those terms. But at the same time, it wasn't useful, because I sort of, you know, I was sort of panicking about this book in some regards. And I would suddenly, you know, I'd be just writing every day and concentrating on, you know, the next sentence, the next word, the next piece of punctuation, whatever. And you're down on the page, and it is like, you know, the sentences are like mazes you're moving through or moving around. And you don't necessarily always have that like macro view of it. But suddenly I'd be like, and this happened for like a year, I'd be walking along or I'd be getting dressed or doing whatever, and suddenly the thought would just arrive like a truck hitting me. It'd be just like, what if it's shit? Like, what if it's like really bad? What if it doesn't work? And I was, you know, the more I thought about that, it was always to do with these elements that were, I guess, the most thrillerist. Like, I don't think it's coincidental, looking back on it now, that all the elements of the story that Robert is most doubtful about are probably the ones that I sort of agonized most over, about trying to get right and worrying that I might not get them right, and sort of worked hardest at. So I think there was a sort of mirroring there between me and him.
And how would you have known if it had been, I mean, I saw an exchange that you had today on the great sort of, because it's the way that sometimes writers can display their various insecurities. But you were chatting on Twitter today and you shared a message that the critic Leo Robson had sent you. And you said you'd sent it to him. There's a reply to something you'd sent to him a couple of years ago where you said, this is a total fucking disaster. And he said, no, you've already written the book, you can do it again, something of that nature. But when you say, did you actually think this book is just not going to exist? I can't, this is not going to come to anything.
It's a weird, there's a strange and constant like doubleness. And I think most writers, maybe all artists, I'm not sure, quite possibly, but certainly all writers are a kind of, you know, this worrying or turbulent blend of egotism and crippling self-doubt. It's like, I'm brilliant because I'm going to spend 2 years like doing this one thing that I'll get like no feedback on for like at least a year. But it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. You know, you've got to have some sort of like self-belief to do that in the first place. But at the same time, you kind of like, you know, you read 10 wonderful reviews and then you read one random comment on Amazon and you're like, I don't know. It just, you know, worms its way into you somehow. So I think that I was very worried about the book for a long time. But at the same time, and during the same day, and during the same writing period, I could be completely not worried about the book as well. And those two things were kind of existing on parallel tracks. And sometimes they sort of merged, and sometimes they split apart again.
Well, you know, I think we feel some of that anxiety coming through in this portrait of Robert, who is a novelist at the heart of the book, who, well, I mean, I'm quite sorry for his wife. I think his wife is quite sorry for herself. Sometimes she's always telling him to buck his ideas up. It is noticeable that his main response to sitting down with a day of writing in front of him is to go onto his balcony and roll cigarettes. And I especially liked the bit where his agent says in an email, "How's the novel coming?" And he writes a kind of tortured reply and then deletes it all. Says, "Coming together." And so this is great. I mean, he is just not writing it, is he? I don't think, you know, you were clearly more generative than that, but he's just not writing his book at all, is he?
He's not. I mean, he's stuck. And I think, yeah, I heard someone talking about this yesterday. I can't remember where, but not trusting writers who maybe I shouldn't say that. It's a bit pejorative. Talking about me, I think that, you know, I find writing like very difficult, and I'm not one of those people who like, oh, don't read my book, it's terrible. I'm really proud of this book. I think it's really good. You know, other people will have different opinions, but in the process of getting there, it's like quite a painful process, and you have to revisit it, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 times. And sometimes those experiences are joyous, and sometimes they are absolutely nightmarish to you, and you don't want to put that on other people, like people you live with or whatever. You know, you try not to, and sometimes you do, and hopefully you get sort of called up on it, because everyone has you know, crappy days at work, and that's part of it. But I do think, yeah, I find writing very difficult, and I'm not one of those people who kind of goes, well, I have to write every day. If I don't write every day, I feel, you know, like just completely, you know, beside myself. Because I wouldn't say I like actively look for reasons not to write, but I'm, you know, there are certain stages I get to where I'm a lot happier. Like, I love editing. I can edit, you know, till the cows come home. But that blank page can, yeah, sometimes be joyous. Often it's a snowy waste in which your doom is enclosed.
There is a very strong sense of watching Robert try and fail to write his book but roll a lot of cigarettes, etc., that when he comes into contact with someone who's saying, you don't look now, there's a kind of Secret Service guy behind us, he probably is going to kill us. This is a really sexy and exciting thing to happen to his life, which for the rest of the time, alongside not writing, consists of quite boring childcare duties and domestic negotiation, against the backdrop of having come to live in Berlin. The novel is set in Berlin, and that's obviously quite exciting, but it's not really available to him because he's sort of mired in the world of bringing up two small kids with his wife in a relatively kind of small flat with presumably not inexhaustible funds. And that seems to me a big part of it, that actually when you're sitting down and you're trapped in your own mundane life, the sexiness of men with guns and oligarchs and assassinations is just too much of a lure. And I thought that was kind of something you were sort of getting at in the book, why we're just fascinated by these stories. Why perhaps you got fascinated by Litvinenko and Itzu?
Yeah, I think that sounds like a sidekick all of a sudden.
I actually realised what I just said was, your life is so boring that you got really into it. And I didn't mean it like that. I think you know what I mean.
It's fine, Alex. How do I leave this meeting? I think, I think that's true. But I think he's thinking about it in the sense that most people think about it, which is as a story, as like a ripping yarn or whatever. He's not. If he immediately thought what Patrick was saying was really true, to the extent he always believes some of it. But to the extent that, you know, oh, and these people are coming after me and I'm in danger. If he really thought that through and really believed it, I don't think he'd act as he does. I don't think he'd find that so sort of sexy and exciting, as you say. I think it's because that stuff does exist on a news program or on the you know, newspaper front page or wherever it is. There's a sense. Yeah, that it happens like over there, you know, like it doesn't touch him. And he's someone who's too busy to be in a thriller. You know, he's got kids to pick up from the nursery and he's got, you know, a wife to try and hang on to. And, you know, he can't do that thing in sort of some thrillers where normal life gets cleared away like quite quickly. Sometimes, you know, skillfully by the writer and sometimes more clumsily by the writer. But people in thrillers sometimes or often realize they're in a thriller quite quickly, and that becomes like the whole thing, like the situation is engineered so that it's, you know, the plot sort of becomes dominant. But certainly Robert is resistant to that in a way that I think a lot of people would be. I mean, partly because these are sort of like corner of the eye things that you can write on or you can make excuses for. You know, when weird things happen in our own lives, whatever they might be, we normally rationalize them, you know, until we no longer can. You know, we rationalize them, and most of the time they are, you know, there is an explanation and you just sort of forget about them. But that's not always possible.
But it's interesting. We were talking about genre earlier, and that kind of idea of somebody who gets sucked into something that they simply don't understand because they are quite excited by the thrill of it, the glamour of it. The sort of promise it seems to have to liberate them from whatever jam. In this case, you know, this is going to be an interesting subject to write about. And then it is far too hot to handle. I mean, that is quite a sort of staple of noir writing, isn't it? And I know we were talking a while back and I said I thought, I mean, I was really overexcited. I just read the book and I really liked it. And I said, do I think there's a bit of Highsmith about it? And you said, no, that's too much. But I did think that because there is this sense of these kind of doubles, these two characters who stalk each other around this kind of cityscape with very uncertain motives and with a great kind of sense of not really knowing how these forces and desires are going to kind of play out for them. And I thought that was something that was really powerful in the novel, that they just didn't really know what they were doing. Is that
well,
fair?
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, that is fair. I you know, I guess that's I often don't know what I'm doing, or I certainly feel like I don't know what I'm doing. And I think, yeah, there is a sort of fumbling or uncertain quality to them. And the Highsmith comparison is very complimentary. And to throw other, you know, big names around, I was certainly thinking about writers like Roberto Bolaño and Patrick Modiano. You know, when I started, they were a couple of names I sort of wrote down in a sort of throwback to school days when I'd, you know, write band names on my bag and stuff. But I was writing them down as kind of, you know, tutelary spirits of the book. And they are writers who employ genre in kind of like a unheimlich kind of way, you know. It's like detective novels but make it weird or whatever, you know. It's like it's got a strange twisted element to it, and probably sort of it's not so interested in resolution. It's more interested in the establishment of the mystery and the problem and identity within that, and that was sort of they were useful for me to not really like, read while I was writing the book. I sort of avoided that, but just to think of the atmospheres their work presents to me was a useful sort of guide for me.
It also seems kind of important to me, to the book, that it is set in Berlin, where this person is not from, where the other writer, Patrick, is not from, in these spaces that are kind of almost zoned. You know, there are places that people go to and come back from, and big streets to cross, and there's a kind of amazing sort of running scene at one point that's kind of filled with danger and jeopardy and fear. And it is important that nobody is at home, but none of the people that you're writing about are from there, isn't it? And it seems to be that sort of juxtaposition between the domestic setting and this kind of completely sort of anonymous city to which no one belongs around it. You couldn't have set it here, could you?
No, I think that to establish that sort of sense of dislocation is quite important. I think a lot of people feel dislocated. I think people always feel like they're on the outside of things, whoever they are, probably. Like, I think there are very few people who think, like, this is it. I am at the center of, like, you know, everything. I'm perfectly positioned. Just doesn't happen. And I think in fiction, that's situating people in places like that can be useful, or I find it quite powerful, because for someone to be an outsider in the place where they grew up, or in the place that they, you know, have lived in for a long time, that it almost, their outsiderness becomes like the overriding trait of their personality, I suppose, with it as a fictional character. But if someone's, you know, just moved to a city, or they've, you know, gone on holiday and they're in a new place, then you have that dislocation kind of right there from the off, and it doesn't sort of overpower things. It's almost like the foundation that you build the story on. And in a sort of realistic or practical sense, Berlin appealed because it is a place where, say, Patrick's like running away. He doesn't really know where he's going to go. This is like a sort of first stop for him. Like, he might stay there. He doesn't know. But it is somewhere that certainly over the last sort of 20, 25 years, someone, an English speaker, can go and function pretty easily for good or ill. You know, there's a whole sort of, you know, Berlin's probably at the front edge of gentrification and all that entails more than any other place on earth, but you know, he can be there, and yes, it's got that heritage as well of, yeah, being a divided city and Le Carré and Ambler and whomever, and you know, those resonances, those ghosts are kind of present there as well.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You mentioned Le Carré there, and there definitely is that kind of atmosphere. And as you say, that sort of, you know, a Brit abroad, two Brits abroad here. But having mentioned the other writers that you did, that book at the beginning that both characters reach for in the bookshop is Roberto Bolaño's Antwerp, I think. Isn't it? Which is in the not obviously for our incredibly well-read audience now tonight, but I mean it's quite an obscure reference, isn't it, of a book?
Yeah, it is, and it's not, you know, that book doesn't sort of unlock anything necessarily.
No.
I wanted to nod to to him in the text, but the book itself was, yeah, I mean, to be quite honest, I can't actually remember why I chose it to be Antwerp, but that's...
Well, I just assumed it was a kind of little sort of in-joke to yourself, you know, to put a favourite book in there, but it also seemed to me signpost the novel trying to look outwards and to say, you know, this is... to be situated, I suppose, in a kind of broader range of reading than just like a kind of American noir or a British spy thriller, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, he's definitely a big writer for me. I think the reason I chose that book now, remembering their exchange when they discuss it, it was, you know, I wanted something that they would sort of disagree about. Like Patrick and Robert, they're quite different. They're very similar in some ways and very, very distinct in others. And it was the kind of book that, you know, you could see a journalist and a fiction writer kind of clashing over, because it's very sort of dreamlike and it's sort of, it's quite close to poetry. It's very sort of disjointed or sort of almost disembodied. And so, yeah, they have this difference of opinion over its literary merit.
What we haven't, the thing that we kind of really need to get to is the business of dealing stories, because essentially, and I think this, I don't want to spoiler the book in any kind of way, but I think that's a fairly sort of clear thing that's going to happen, isn't it? This writer who's blocked meets another writer with an exciting life. Well, you know, what's going to happen? And that sense of literary ownership and that sense of actually just stitching someone else up by stealing their material is actually a really fun one, because we don't know really whether to censure Robert or to go, you know, go on, my son, have a go. Why not? He's not doing anything with it. What did you mean by putting it in there? And would you have said this is too good a story to part? In fact, is this someone else's story?
No. Is the Faber lawyer on the call? No.
It's just us. You can say anything. It's literally just us.
Well, between you and me. Yeah, I did want to talk. I didn't set out, you know, I didn't get out my graph paper and say, you know, these are the points I want to hit. It was this, you know, novels are, I think, quite a quite chaotic things, but they naturally absorb, you know, your interests along the way, even though you didn't necessarily think those particular interests were gonna be in the story. But yes, once I had these two writers and one trying to extract the story from the other along the way, that obviously raised that question about ownership of a story. The simple idea that someone tells you something that happens to them and you're like, oh, that's great, I'd like to write about that. And I think there are ethical ways to do that, and I think there are unethical ways to do it. And I think it's a sort of case by case thing, but you know, there are definitely things that Robert could have quite easily done that would have been, you know, made what he does more acceptable. But at the same time, I've got sympathy for him in that he's, you know, someone who's struggling and desperate, and he sees this opportunity. And I think in his mind, he doesn't want to like risk losing it by doing the right thing, by announcing what he wants to do and kind of asking permission. He's worried that Patrick will just say, well, no, I don't want, you know, I'm uncomfortable about the whole thing. I'm sort of, you know, fleeing for my life. Why would I want to sit and tell you the whole story? So he goes about it, you know, he extracts it by, he sort of presents himself falsely as a friend, really. And I think I think it's a vexed question. And albeit that part of the story isn't, you know, vexed personally for me, there are other elements in the story that are. There's a funeral or a viewing that takes place in the book that I wanted to talk to people about. The affected people, you know, and I wanted to talk to them and say, you know, I'm writing this and you know, tell them.
Just to explain, because it's a very kind of, it's almost a discrete section in the book, if such a thing is possible, because obviously it does all the bits of the book talk to each other. But it is a moment when Robert leaves Berlin, comes back to London to go to a funeral of a friend. what you're saying, that seems to be to bear relation to real life. And so that was something that was difficult for you to put in, or to feel that kind of legitimacy in putting in.
Well, this is the question. I mean, this is the most difficult part to talk about, but also I think the most interesting or most valuable part to talk about, because that gets to the root of it. It's like, it wasn't difficult to put in. What was difficult was telling people involved, like family members of this person, that I was doing it, I wanted to write about it. That's the difficult part. The sort of deciding to put it in is where the Graham Greene line about writers having a chip of ice in the heart sort of thing comes into play. You know, if you want to write about something, you don't sort of go, oh, I'd like to write about that, but I shouldn't, or whatever. That's almost like that kicks in later. And then hopefully you do the right thing and you talk to people about it if you feel that that's necessary. But the actual decision to write about something, I think, is quite sort of automatic, or there's an element of ruthlessness there. I don't know. I'm still figuring it out, because I'm like, well, that was something I experienced as well. But at the same time, it's strange for people. If people are suddenly picking up, you know, a book and reading about something that affected them, it's an odd experience, and someone's recollection of something is never going to be the same as someone else's, especially if it's, you know, an emotionally powerful event like that.
Sure, but just sort of pushing on that, and you might tell me to back off because it does relate to something in your own life. I mean, when you talk about that way of characterising something as an example of the writer's splinter in the heart, which is, you know, is a kind of accepted way to talk about these things, but it also slightly elides the fact that maybe you wanted to write about it because it was valuable to you at some kind of emotional level. Not just that you thought it would make a good, productive, interesting, valuable scene in a book. And it strikes me that's what that negotiation between that, it's the motive for writing about something that's sometimes the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, that's interesting, because I do think, yeah, when I first wanted to write about it, I wanted to write about it because it was an extremely emotional event that made a, you know, very deep impression on me. But over the course of writing something as fiction, you know, it never occurred to me. I'm not a memoirist. I didn't ever think, oh, I'll write this as a, you know, as a non-fiction account of something that happened. It was always going to be, you know, incorporated into fiction. And I think it's the incorporation that is the bit that I not struggle with, but can't quite clarify exactly what's wrong, what's right, or gives me pause, because once it becomes incorporated, then it becomes a different thing anyway. It's no longer it's no longer about sort of, you know, honoring the truth or accurately describing that event. What you're trying to do is make really vital, you know, interesting, great fiction, however you do. So it becomes a kind of an aesthetic thing. And so it changes its nature. And I think your willingness to do that, in the process of doing that, you kind of burn up the reality. That's the fuel you're using to generate the fiction. And so it changes your memory. You know, I've spent 2.5 years revisiting that scene at various points. And so my fictional version of it has completely colonized the real event. So although the original impulse becomes something quite different by the time it's been, like I said, incorporated into fiction.
You do touch on this in the book, and we will come to audience questions in about 1 minute. I just keep thinking of more things I'm desperate to ask you while I have you here, and there's no possibility of bumping in the pub, etc. But I wanted to ask you about that bit in when Robert's sort of reflecting on the stories that he's written, and he sort of has shown them. He says he's shown them to his parents, and his mother says, "You're not supposed to make things up. You're not supposed to write about us." And that seems to me where it sort of touches on. Now, you did write a collection of short stories called Mothers, and that is always, I mean, it's just an emotional word. It's always going to make people think of personal experience, despite the fact that it's simply a noun. You know, it's always going to make people think it's going to be personal. Dancing that line is kind of, it seems to me, one of the things you're sort of interested in.
Yeah, I suppose so. But I suppose so, not to sort of duck it, but because I think that's just kind of like hardwired into fiction anyway. Like, I don't think it's necessarily, you know, I mean, you look at the history of the novel, you look at, you know, Robinson Crusoe. Daniel Defoe wanted people to think Robinson Crusoe was a memoir, you know, it was like a real life thing.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of,
yeah, that sort of, the way fiction sticks athwart those lines is, it's just in there, whether you're writing something that's, you know, auto-fictional or like might nod to the writer's life or whatever the elements are. I think that, you know, if fiction's working, then it becomes real, right? For as long as you're like engaged with that book, it generates reality anyway. So I guess the sort of question of what's drawn from life and what isn't drawn from life becomes immaterial. And I suppose that's that element of, you know, the writer's approach to it is sort of like the chilling part of it isn't that they're happy to use, you know, real events or other people's experiences. It's the fact that they sort of don't see a distinction between the two, between the real and the completely invented. They'll, you know, whatever works together is going to satisfy them ultimately as creators.
Chris, shall I stop mercilessly grilling you and making you really uncomfortable by asking you which bits you've nicked from your life and ask some of the audience's questions? Somebody says, how does it feel? Now, I say somebody because they are actually anonymous, not because I can't be bothered to read their name. How does it feel to know the book is landing on doormats and in people's hands? Is it different to articles being published or when Mothers was published?
Yeah, it is different. It's very exciting. I mean, it's really gratifying and you know, it becomes a different thing. I guess it helps you sort of disengage from it because it becomes something different for readers, you know, or they sort of bring their own readings to it, which I love hearing about and finding out. You know, I read, you know, every review, you know, professional and non. If someone's written something about my book, or even if it's something like an underpass, I'll go and, you know, read it. Because it's just, it's sort of exciting, even if, you know, you don't understand what they're saying or you completely disagree with it, whatever. It's like, I find that really, a really fascinating part of publishing, because the book's no longer, you know, the property of either the person who's written it or people who've been working on it for so long that it's partly theirs as well, like my editor, my agent, you know, close, trusted readers. Now it's there for anyone to come along and you know, work out what it means.
We have a question from somebody who has given their name. It's Jana, and I know Jana, so hello back to you. Thank you for asking a question. Did you find any difficulty in writing when writing a full-length novel as opposed to the short stories?
Moments were obviously, you know, much more extended. Yeah, it was the sense that I didn't, you know, you can, if you're writing a short story, that short story might take you years and years to get right, but you sort of know within a few weeks if it's worth pursuing. But with this, it really felt like it could, for the first, I'd say, like, 8 months to a year, there was a sort of House of Cards element to it where, you know, the whole thing could collapse at any moment. So I guess, but in terms of actual the daily writing, there was really no difference. You're just trying to, you know, work out the best word to follow the next. So that's no change. But there is that, there's a much longer period where you're like, is this, you know, a complete act of folly or is it actually worth pursuing?
David Heddlethwaite asks, do you feel that A Lonely Man returns to the themes you explored in Mothers, or is it more of a departure? You did mention a bit earlier that there were some similarities in terms of atmospheres of tension and suspense.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I'm always interested in. I like fiction that has that sort of tensile quality, and that can be about anything. It doesn't mean it has to be, you know, about people getting, you know, chased or sort of paranoid fantasists or anything. I think there's just something within the sentences or the rhythm that I respond to and what I want to try and do in my writing. Yeah, I think there are themes that sort of recur. None of them, you know, deliberate. They're obviously just hang-ups or issues that I'm compelled to
put. Tell us about the hang-ups. Come on.
I don't know. I think it's just those things that get those things that seem to that talk to each other between the stories and this book, certainly sort of ideas of dislocation, ideas of not feeling, you know, entirely at home in a situation or in an environment. You know, missed connections. I think one of the defining things between Patrick and Robert is that, you know, I think in a different situation, like they could have been really good friends. There's you know, they could have been quite sympathetic towards each other and quite helpful for each other if they'd met under different circumstances, I think.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think that, but I didn't write the book. the brilliant writer Tony White is here. He says, congratulations, Chris, can't wait to read it. How does your work reviewing fiction, brackets, you're a very accomplished critic / book reviewer, close brackets, inform your own fiction writing? You are a very good critic. And would you recommend emerging authors who are just starting out to also write reviews? I'll just leap in and say I've written about 6,000 reviews in my life. I've never written a book. So it can work, you know. You can spend all your, perhaps paltry in my case, energies on writing reviews, but obviously hasn't sapped your strength, kind of Samson style.
Well, thank you, Tony, for that. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've written reviews for more than 20 years now, just. And it's funny, you know, when Mothers came out, I was asked quite a bit, completely understandably, you know, in retrospect, how does it feel having been a critic for so long to sort of put your head above the parapet, I think was the kind of analogy, and you know, write fiction. But in my head, I'd been a fiction writer since I was like 8. You know, the only missing part was that I wasn't writing any fiction. But that was completely, you know, what I was doing. All my friends were like, you know, knew that was what was happening, even though I blatantly wasn't doing it. So the criticism and fiction, again, were on sort of parallel tracks. Like they are different, I think, but they certainly inform one another. I mean, you know, all the books I've read, whether I was, you know, writing a review of them or not, have sort of fed into my own writing. But I think what's helpful about writing a review is that you have to really try and clarify what you think about a book, and you have to sort of make an argument about what you think about a book. And as you know very well, and you have to, you know, dig that little bit deeper. You can't just put it down and go, oh, I really like that, or, you know, that was okay, but it should have done X, Y, Z. You have to really, you know, justify your own arguments and work out why you think that about it. And I think that's valuable in terms of your own writing, because you've just got that, again, not in a particularly conscious way, but I think it's all there in the kind of, you know, mulch that you're drawing on when you're writing fiction. Because I think a lot of the time when you're writing fiction, you're not really, you're conscious, I guess, but you're not really deliberately drawing on things or thinking, oh, well, I really like what X or Y writer did, I'm going to use that. But it's all getting thrown up somehow as you're sort of desperately searching for the next word.
In the mulch. It's a real shame, critic-wise, that you can't sometimes just go, I really like this. Like, maybe do that for 800 words, because it can't. Sometimes you're like, I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. I'm talking about myself here. We've got two more questions and not so much more time, but we'll be quick. Amber says, you incorporate so much factual detail. What was your system keeping track of this alongside your other material?
Yeah, just reading like heaps of stuff, laboriously like copying it out into various. I use Scrivener, this you know, writing program that lots of people will be familiar with, and I'd put loads of it into very intricately designed sections and subsections, and then most of it I just forgot about and never looked at again. But I think it helped that it was there somewhere.
Quite comforting to do. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I had to read a lot of it and also sort of forget about it to an extent. There were certainly drafts of this book that had much more than needed to be there, as my editor quite rightly told me. And that was, you know, valuable to it's better to like have too much and scrape it away rather than, you know, not have enough, I think.
I've got a last question here, which is a really good question that I didn't get to enough. It says, congrats, eager to read. It sounds like it's an ode to the big cities like Berlin and London while diving into real life vulnerabilities as a creative. Have we managed to reach dangers of those sexy oligarchs and guns that used to be just fiction and Hollywood? I'm particularly interested about the idea of the ode to the cities, because there is that kind of feeling of exciting possibility, as I said, that he doesn't quite get to, can't quite get to. But there is this feeling of a world of possibility, not just of things that you can do, but just of stories multiplying.
Yeah, I think, I love Berlin. I love London. I do love, you know, being in a city. And obviously that's something that's been very much challenged or excised over the last year, because you can't really gather in that way, or you can only in sort of isolated pockets of time between lockdowns. But yeah, I mean, I rode today down to Hackney, and I rode down to Peckham and then back to Hackney, and yeah, just that sense of passing all these, you know, I was on side streets, I was on main roads, I was getting lost quite a lot and consulting my map. But that sense of all these lives around you, and the fact that you can or could, you know, wander into a pub or a bookshop or whatever and have a you know, a strange, enticing encounter, is one of the thrills of cities, right? And it's what sort mm-hmm. of makes up for all the difficulties. Well, the difficulties themselves can be thrilling. I think they demand a lot, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It kind of keeps you vital in a sense.
Chris, we have run out of time. I'll just say again how much I enjoyed this book. I really, really loved it. I was completely gripped. You actually left the house and went into the actual shop and signed copies, didn't you? So there are signed copies for people to buy. If you look in the Q&A, I think there's a link. And also if you look on the website, you will see lots of other events at the excellent London Review of Books Bookshop, where we long to do events in person again. I will say that they're very tall chairs. I am sitting on a less tall chair that I'm less frightened of slipping off this evening, but it is nothing like congregating outside the LRB bookshop with a glass of warm white wine after a wonderful event. Would please have us back there soon. Chris, thank you so much. I'm sorry that you have to do a more or less virtual book tour. Thank you very much. And thank you to all our audience. Good night. Happy Easter.
Thanks for coming, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.